damage weapon. It's what you use when you can't get a bigger gun. So what kind of gun do you recommend then? To me, low damage was getting hit in the head with a ping pong ball, not a .45 caliber hollow point bullet, traveling 835 feet a second. McNeese suggested a 12-gauge shotgun with an 18.5-inch barrel. He recommended using slugs for outdoor shooting, and for indoors, birdshot, which is less likely to penetrate a wall and hurt a family member. Apparently, I was going to need heavier artillery for my urban survival kit. Nearby, a group of students and instructors were making fun of Democrats, gun control laws, and anyone from California. There's no constitutional amendment that's been more crippled and regulated than the Second Amendment, a competitive shooter was saying about the right to keep and bear arms. After eavesdropping for a while, I began to realize that all my life I'd been a hypocrite. As a journalist, I'd always supported the right to free speech, but been opposed to guns. However, by playing favorites with the amendments, it wasn't the Founding Fathers' vision of America I was fighting for. It was just my personal opinion. Though I'd passed the writing and shooting tests at gun sight, which made me eligible for the permit to carry a concealed weapon, I discovered that I needed to send a set of fingerprints to the state of Arizona to receive it. And these would be kept on file permanently. So I was faced with a dilemma. Which was more important, my safety or my privacy? After weeks of debate, I chose privacy. If the social order ever broke down, no one would be checking for concealed weapons permits anyway. Spencer, meanwhile, was solving the same problem the B way. I've actually been trying to find a podunk place where I can buy the police a squad car in exchange for being named an off-duty cop, he said when I called to tell him about my brand new pistol skills. That way, I can carry a concealed weapon anywhere. He hesitated for a moment. I want to have it ready for the next fiscal crisis. This wouldn't be my last gun class. I would eventually purchase and learn to use a Remington 870 Wingmaster shotgun with a ventilated rib barrel and a Model 700 rifle with a Tasco Super Sniper scope. Thanks to Kurt Saxon, Mel Tappan, and Bruce Clayton, I'd become a gun nut. I'd become one of the guys I would have been too scared to hang out with on the Millennial New Year. It's amazing how easy it was to turn that corner. Lesson 30. Why you should think of the zoo as a restaurant. There is a language of survival. WTSHTF is short for when the shit hits the fan. And, as disastrous as that may sound, it's not nearly as bad as EOTWAWKI, the end of the world as we know it. Bugging out is slang for leaving your home to go somewhere safe. To do so, you'll want a bug-out bag, or BOB, full of survival supplies for the road. A bug-out vehicle, or BOV, which will get you out of the impact zone and through traffic as quickly as possible. And a bug-out location, or BOL, stocked with enough provisions to get you through whatever crisis is occurring. So, in short, WTSHTF, you're going to want a BOB to bring into your BOV, to go to your BOL, where you'll pray it isn't EOTWAWKI. I learned all this on the survivalist boards. When I returned home from gun sight, I noticed that most of my friends grew fidgety whenever I began discussing my quest for a passport, a Swiss bank, and bigger and better firearms. Either they thought I'd gone off the deep end, or they wanted to talk about something more directly related to their interests, like whether Rock Band was better than Guitar Hero. This was before gas prices soared, banks collapsed, and my friends began feeling the terror in their pocketbooks. Most people tend not to care about political, economic, and ecological problems until they're personally inconvenienced by them. Thankfully, there's this thing called the internet, where individuals who feel alone in their predilections can discover a community of people who share their interests. If Armin Maiwas, a cannibal in Germany, could use the internet to find 200 people volunteering to be killed, cooked, and eaten. Surely I could find a community of survivalists to give me advice. All it took was one search for Survivalist Forum to find survivalistboards.com, which soon became a daily obsession. The Survivalist Boards were a treasure trove of post-apocalyptic suggestions, ranging from hunting for food at the local zoo if game becomes scarce, to making a gun out of galvanized plumbing pipe, a dowel, a nail, duct tape, and a small piece of cardboard. I read the boards for days, trying to separate the useful practical advice from the black helicopters following me paranoia. I didn't know when or whether my St. Kitts citizenship would come through, so I wanted to train as quickly, intensely, and efficiently as possible. In addition, because I didn't plan on living in the Caribbean full-time, I needed to be prepared for the more likely scenario that something would go wrong while I was still in Los Angeles. As long as I was joining hidden communities, I also signed up for a perpetual traveler mailing list called PT Refuge. Survivalists understood handheld tools like guns, knives, archery bows, fishing poles, and can openers. But they had almost no interest in non-tangible tools like passports, trusts, LLCs, and numbered accounts. Perhaps they didn't think these things would still be around when the shit hits the fan. Or more likely, judging by some of the survivalists I corresponded with, they clung fiercely to their own conception of America, and a shit-hits-the-fan scenario was also an opportunity to form a militia and remake the country according to their own ideals. I called Spencer to tell him to check out the survivalist boards. He was in St. Kitts with his brother and his parents, who, unlike my family, supported his endeavors. They were getting citizenships, too. "I knew you'd catch on eventually," he told me. "Thanks, I think." "These are the kinds of things you should be considering," he continued as he scrolled through the posts. "The way I see it, there are only two situations we need to be prepared for. Since I discovered the boards, I've been thinking the same thing. Bugging in and bugging out? If that's what they call it, yes. First, you need to have enough supplies at home so you can survive with no help from anything or anyone in the outside world. Next, you need an escape route in case you have to leave your home, and that escape route should lead you to a safe retreat. Like St. Kitts? Once we get our passports," he sighed. He'd been feuding over contract deals with the developer of the property he wanted to buy, so he hadn't even filed for his citizenship yet. "Our biggest challenge," he continued, "is going to be just getting out of the city, because traffic will be bumper to bumper." "I'll tell you what," I replied. "Have a good time in St. Kitts. I'll look into ways to bug out when the shit hits the fan." I was already talking like a hardcore survivalist. Lesson 31. Motorbikes of the Apocalypse. After getting off the phone with Spencer, I made my first post on the survivalist boards, a plea for advice on how to escape the city when the shit hits the fan. Most of the experts advised moving out of the city immediately. But just like the decision not to turn my fingerprints into the government, I wasn't ready to compromise my freedom and enjoyment of life for security. A second citizenship added options and opportunities to my life. Living next door to Kurt Saxon would only remove options and narrow possibilities. Others responded with vivid scenarios worthy of a Hollywood blockbuster. One poster, who went by the name Dewey, advised, "The best thing, given your situation, is to arm yourself to the teeth to fend off looters and gangs, build yourself an excellent B.O.B., and keep a month's worth of rations at your residence to weather out the initial exodus of sheeple and eventual gang wars. I'd lay low, let all the gangs kill each other off first, expect that within 2 to 3 weeks, then prepare to hoof it. Thus, an excellent BOB is essential, as is carefully selected firearms. You're definitely going to need a semi-automatic rifle with high magazine capacity." Others gave less morbid advice that I never would have come up with myself. "Might I suggest a different path?" Laser Cool wrote. If escaping beforehand is not an option, you might want to get involved with the local disaster management organizations run by the government. Here in Miami, the police run a CERT team, Community Emergency Response Team. You can get decent training, a snazzy vest, and most of all, contacts within law enforcement. You'll be seen as one of the good guys, and often that can make the difference between getting through a roadblock and not getting through. Finally, a handful of others on the forum insisted that I purchase a motorcycle with saddlebags and study local trail maps so I could escape via isolated mountain roads instead of crowded, chaotic highways. The only problem was that I didn't know how to ride a motorcycle. I'd tried once before, during an interview with Tom Cruise at a motorcycle raceway, but it ended in disaster. I wiped out on his expensive 955cc Triumph bike. Though he didn't seem to mind the damage to the motorcycle, I was humiliated. Fortunately, the survivalists were helpful and thorough. They suggested the best place to train, the Motorcycle Safety Foundation. They suggested the best survival bike to buy, the rugged Rokon Trailbreaker, used by U.S. Special Forces in Desert Storm. And they suggested the biggest hazards to watch out for, a saboteur stringing piano wire across the road to decapitate me, an attacker lurking around a corner wielding a 2x4, and a motorist shooting me in the back to get a free motorcycle. I was impressed by their imaginations. They reminded me of Katie and her movie-inspired fears. Maybe she'd make a good survivalist after all. Since the risks seemed improbable, I signed up for a course with the Motorcycle Safety Foundation and looked into the Rokon Trailbreaker. With a two-wheel drive system, wide tractor-like tires, and hollow aluminum wheels capable of storing gas and water, the Rokon was a survival machine, able to ride through mud puddles and streams 2 feet deep, over mountains of rubble, and through snow-covered fields. While cars were stuck bumper to bumper on the freeway, I'd be able not just to weave around them, but to cruise along the median, the shoulder, the embankment, and even, if necessary, over the tops of abandoned cars. For the next step in my evacuation route, I did something Spencer had advised when we first met. I researched flying lessons. I couldn't believe I was about to take my pursuit of offshore safety this far, but Spencer was right. If I was going to have a compound in St. Kitts, I'd need a way to get there. Though the survivalist recommended using a kit to build my own ultralight plane, my tool skills at the time prohibited anything with words like kit, build, model, or construct, unless they involved small interlocking rectangular blocks or cheap Swedish furniture. As I sat through flight school orientation, it occurred to me that the lessons would be a long and costly commitment. On the positive side, spending time at the airport would enable me to make friends who flew planes and worked in control towers in case I needed them. On the negative side, a single-engine plane on a day with a good tailwind would only fly as far as Santa Fe on a tank of gas. I decided to take a few lessons anyway until I came across a better option. Though a single-engine plane wouldn't get me to St. Kitts, at least it would get me across the border. Before I could start flying, however, I needed to give the flight school, Justice Aviation, a copy of my driver's license and proof of my U.S. citizenship, such as a passport or birth certificate. Between my flight lessons, gun purchases, and suspicious internet searches, at least the ones I'd made before taking Grandpa's anonymity advice, I was pretty sure I'd caught the attention of the government. I'd recently read that James Moore, the co-author of a negative book on Karl Rove called Bush's Brain, had been added to the no-fly list. Hopefully, I wouldn't be next. The tools we need to protect ourselves, I realized, are nearly identical to those that others are using to kill us. Perhaps, then, the only difference between the good guys and the bad guys is intent, because by not trusting the state, I'd made myself indistinguishable from its enemies. Lesson 32. Bathroom Tips for Combat Soldiers. Motorcycle school was just as humiliating as gun school. Not only was I inexperienced, but I was one of the few people in class who'd never even driven stick shift before. Perhaps I wasn't so much getting prepared for hard times as I was catching up to normal people, driving stick, shooting guns, farming, and using tools are things every man should know. But my friends and I had never bothered to learn these basic skills, because everything had always been handed to us. Public transportation, fast food, the Yellow Pages, and Craigslist had made them seem unnecessary. Just as I squeezed triggers too hard, I throttled the bike too much. When weaving around cones, I inevitably crushed them, and during a stopping exercise, I braked so suddenly that the rear wheel locked and the bike tipped over. It wasn't until the last day of class that I realized what was holding me back, my sphincter. I was worrying too much about braking, throttling, balancing, and releasing the clutch at just the right times while under the scrutiny of the instructors. And the more I thought, the worse I rode. As I approached a row of cones, I took a deep breath and decided to trust my instincts instead of thinking so hard about trying to do everything perfectly. This time, I carved around the cones gracefully, without hitting a single one. Yet when it came time to repeat my performance during the final exam, my sphincter shrunk back to the size of a needle's eye, and I didn't even come close to passing. To truly learn to survive in stressful situations, I need to take the motto of the survivalist boards, endure, adapt, overcome, to heart, and learn to relax my sphincter permanently instead of tightening it whenever confronted with a challenge. Or, as security consultant Gavin De Becker put it less scatologically in his book The Gift of Fear, I needed to learn to disengage my logic brain and engage my wild brain, which instinctively guards and protects. To do this, I bought a book an instructor at Gunsight had mentioned, On Combat by Dave Grossman, which deals with the body's stress response during battle. In fight-or-flight situations, I learned, one of the first things the body does is give up sphincter and bladder control, hence the phrase, scared shitless, so it can commandeer every bit of available strength for battle. That's why some soldiers actually make it a point to go to the bathroom before combat. So maybe McNeese was right about the sphincter. It is for times of peace, not war. Before retaking the motorcycle test, I decided to get a Rokon so I could practice on my own. To help offset the cost, I sold some rare books, CDs, and an old computer. Since I'd gone into survival mode, my intellectual pursuits had begun mattering less to me than physical ones. Perhaps the reason I'd always been a runner was that I never had the physical confidence to fight. One afternoon, as I was practicing to retake my motorcycle test, Katie and her sister pulled up outside my house. Because she was too scared to drive, Katie was almost completely dependent on her sister to get around. However, her sister resented the obligation and frequently failed to pick her up, so Katie had recently been forced to drop out of college for poor attendance and fired from her department store job for missing shifts. When she saw me on the Rokon, her brow knitted and her fear reflex kicked in. "I don't like it," she said. Her fingers instinctually rose to stretch her forehead taut in an attempt to prevent wrinkles from forming. "It's dangerous. I don't trust anything with less than four wheels." For once, I agreed with her. I drove up the street, followed a bend in the road near a neighbor's house, and tried to practice stopping. As I squeezed the brake, the wheel began to slide out from under me. I had forgotten the one lesson I'd learned from my wipeout on Tom Cruise's bike. Never brake when turning. I panicked, and as I released the brake, I accidentally throttled the bike. Instantly, the Rokon accelerated in an arc, rolled up four of the neighbor's stairs, and careened off the ledge to the left, colliding midair with a row of garbage cans. The bike, the cans, and my ribs all clattered loudly to the pavement. My first thought was to marvel at how easily and smoothly my survival bike had climbed the stairs. My second thought was that McNeese and Grossman were right. Because I hadn't learned to stay cool in regular life, I'd panicked in an emergency and hurt myself. Only then did I roll up a pants leg and lift my shirt to inspect the damage. My lower body was a red skid mark, oozing blood. I was turning out to be a shitty survivalist. In the last month, I'd bought guns, started riding motorcycles, and signed up for flying lessons. In my quest for safety, I was pursuing the most dangerous things I'd ever done in my life. The chances of being injured in a terrorist attack or civil unrest were far slimmer than the chances of killing myself in a motorcycle or shooting or flying accident. Survivalism, I realized, is not about staying alive. It's about choosing how you die. Lesson 33. Never drink from the bowl. Kevin Mason, a fireman with Fire Station 88 in Los Angeles, paced back and forth, agitated, in a back room of the First Presbyterian Church in Encino. He was tall, with gray hair and the hardened humor of someone who'd seen people die in his arms. "If there's a big disaster," he was saying, "you cannot expect assistance for how many days?" 3 to 5 days, 40 people recited in a staggered response. "You cannot count on us," Mason continued. By us, he meant the fire department, the police, the ambulance companies, the National Guard, anyone. "So who's going to get you when there's an emergency?" "Nobody," the class thundered. "Nobody's coming to your aid in a disaster," Mason said, drilling the point into the head of every student, business person, housewife, and grandparent in the room. "You have to be independent." This was the cert class the survivalists had recommended, and it had already taught me that my expectation that the government would save and protect its citizens after Hurricane Katrina was unreasonable. According to Mason, the federal plan was, and always had been, let the mess happen and hope the people take care of themselves, then come in, scoop up the survivors, and help the community recover. The CERT program was originally developed by the Los Angeles Fire Department in the mid-80s to help citizens and communities become more self-sufficient in the event of a disaster. After the Federal Emergency Management Agency caught wind of CERT many years later, it took the program nationwide. The more I learned, the more surprised I was that I hadn't made any disaster preparations earlier. Up until then, I'd been so focused on man-made and political catastrophes that I'd given little consideration to nature's many forms of population control. In Los Angeles, an earthquake or wildfire could easily devastate the city, while in St. Kitts, a hurricane could decimate the island. In fact, according to the Uniform California Earthquake Forecast, California had a 99.7% chance of experiencing a severe earthquake rating 6.7 or higher on the Richter scale in the next 30 years. "You have to get that through your head," Mason was saying. "Every year in the country, there are 25,000 disasters. When's our turn?" "Any time," the class recited. "That's right. It's sooner than you think. The San Andreas Fault is overdue. So who's responsible when that happens?" "We are." "Right? And?" He smiled wryly at his students. They knew the line coming next. "It's not looting if you leave a note." This was class number 3 of 7. When it was all over, I would be issued a green CERT vest, a CERT helmet, a patch, a diploma, and a card identifying me as a CERT battalion member. I had originally taken the class solely to obtain these signifiers of authority, hoping they would make bugging out easier. When escaping through the mountains on my Rokon Trailbreaker in my CERT uniform, I figured I'd be able to get past roadblocks by saying I was doing relief work. But I was surprised to discover that the classes were actually valuable. Each one had the potential to save my life. Furthermore, It was reassuring to hear someone with experience, authority, and government credentials justify the concerns I've been having for the past few years. They didn't seem like paranoia anymore. They seemed like common sense. Our first class was about general emergency preparedness. The average person, I learned, needs a gallon of water a day to survive. But after a massive earthquake, Los Angeles could be without water for up to 30 days while workers fix the pipes. So how do you get the gallons you need, especially if you haven't stored any water? Mason taught us there are 40 gallons of drinkable water stored in most home heaters, as well as gallons more in toilet tanks. But, he warned, in his world-weary, people-are-idiots voice, never drink from the bowl. Between classes, drawing on my survivalist books and the survivalist boards for additional guidance, I began stockpiling. I stored 10 gallon-sized jugs of water in the garage, taking care not to put them on the concrete floor, which would react with the plastic and contaminate the water. I bought a 2,000-watt Honda generator, along with a hand crank generator. I filled 5 2-gallon containers with gasoline, then added Stabil to prevent the gas from breaking down. And I tracked down lanterns, kerosene, 44-hour candles, hand crank powered flashlights, rechargeable batteries, strike anywhere matches, water purification tablets, and first aid supplies. My goal was to eventually conduct what Bruce Clayton, in Life After Terrorism, called a 3-day test, which meant shutting off all utilities and living off my stockpile for 3 days to see what supplies I'd overlooked. Afterward, I planned to bring a duplicate set of provisions to St. Kitts. In Class 2, we learned about different types of fires and the various extinguishers designed to put them out. We were taught the 5-second rule. If the fire doesn't get smaller or go out within 5 seconds, evacuate immediately. Then we were taken outside, handed an extinguisher, and given the chance to put out an actual fire, which taught me something very obvious I'd never thought about before. Always aim the nozzle at the base of a fire where the flames are interacting with the fuel. And now I was in Class 3. Today's topic, handling mass casualties. This is the way we look at disasters. We'll get to it, Mason said. Katrina came and went. We'll get to it. I was surprised by the casual way he treated disasters, as if they were television shows that reran every night, rather than tragic historical anomalies that destroyed lives, families, communities, and even generations. He was more of a Flysian than I was. I, at least, lived in a world of order that was occasionally disrupted by chaos. As a fireman, he lived in a world of chaos, occasionally interrupted by order. The goal is not to save everyone, he instructed us. It's to help the greatest amount of people in the least amount of time. So you have to prioritize. You have to sort. That day, we learned START, which stands for Simple Triage and Rapid Treatment. If we were the first to arrive at a mass casualty incident, our job was to sort through the victims swiftly and mark them with a Sharpie or lipstick on their forehead if triage tags weren't available as one of 4 types of casualties: immediate, delayed, minor, or dead. This way, when the professional rescuers came, they'd know who needed treatment and transportation to a hospital first. After triaging, if rescuers still hadn't arrived, Mason instructed us to create treatment areas for the victims. Have bystanders get you medical equipment, he said. Check people's trunks for emergency supplies. If there's a nearby grocery store, have volunteers get whatever they can carry. And remember, the whole class repeated in unison, it's not looting if you leave a note. Despite my paranoia, I didn't think I'd ever have to go to this extreme. But in less than a year, I'd be living the scenario. Find somewhere cool, like the ice chest of a 7-Eleven or an underground parking lot, to store the dead, he continued. The class seemed to get more macabre each week. The coroner will love you if you wrap them with plastic. And don't forget to provide some sort of security, because people will strip the dead of their belongings. There was no irony or humor in his voice, just a lack of faith in human goodness. History is full of tales of people who behave altruistically in disasters, even when resources are scarce. Some will sacrifice their lives to save someone else, or give away their last sip of water, or share their shelter with a destitute family. But history is also full of people who behave viciously in disasters, and will betray, torture, and kill fellow victims to save their own lives. It has yet to be proven which group has a better chance of living, but there's no doubt which group is better able to live with themselves afterward. "Who do you think my best friends in the neighborhood are?" Mason was asking. "The plumbers, contractors, and carpenters. I have a Christmas party every year, and I always invite those guys. Why? Because when it hits the fan, I'm gonna need them." Apparently, Mason was as thorough a survivalist as the guys on the internet forum. I was disturbed to discover that almost every bit of folk wisdom I'd previously learned about surviving natural disasters was wrong. I'd always thought that in an earthquake, for example, the safest place to be was in a doorframe. But Mason taught us that's true for the small number of houses made of adobe or unreinforced masonry. But in the majority of homes, not only is the doorframe one of the weaker parts of the structure, but if you stand inside it, you're likely to get knocked out by flying debris or the door itself. "The safest thing to do during an earthquake," he said, "is hold fast under something sturdy like a table. After checking to make sure there are no windows nearby or heavy objects hanging overhead. As for a hurricane, if you're unable to evacuate, close and brace all exterior and interior doors and windows, then lie on the floor under a sturdy object in a small windowless interior room or closet on the lowest level of the house." Before heading to my fourth cert class, I tried to talk Katie into coming along. "If you know what to do when bad things happen, then maybe you won't be so scared of them anymore," I told her. "I don't know," she replied. "I think if something bad's going to happen, it's going to happen." She muted the movie she was watching, Interview with a Vampire. "If there's an earthquake, the ground will be shaking underneath you, and you'll fall over and hurt your head. There's not much you can do about that. You can't walk around with a helmet all day long." She didn't even have to pause to invent this scenario. I had no clue where some of her ideas came from, because they were too absurd for movies. Perhaps Tom and Jerry cartoons. I tried to reason with her. "But what about fires? Wouldn't it be useful to know how to put them out?" But she turned out to be more reasonable. "I don't think I need to learn to put out a fire, because I don't want to be anywhere near a fire. If I see one, I'll just avoid it." I guess we still had different ways of dealing with our fears. In that week's class, we learned how to stop bleeding, splint broken bones, care for burns, and preserve amputated body parts. The lesson was so useful, not just for survival, but for everyday life, that immediately afterward, I signed up for a slightly more thorough course with the Red Cross. In the next class, we learned the basics of search and rescue. We were taught how to assess whether a building is safe to enter after an earthquake, how different structures are affected by seismic shifts, which parts of a damaged building are most likely to contain victims, and how to use cribbing, small blocks of wood, to lift rubble weighing hundreds or even thousands of pounds off trapped victims. "Who are the rescuers?" Mason asked afterward. "We are." "That's right. We're not going to be able to run the city. If something goes wrong, we'll be looking to you to run the city. Why do you think we give you that green vest with the City of Los Angeles logo on it? You are the trained personnel in a disaster, because we're not coming. We've told you that for 5 weeks." I looked around the room. Half the people seemed like they couldn't climb a staircase without getting winded. "That C on your vest is for community," he continued. "You don't want to be the lone wolf. What happens to the lone wolf? He gets picked off." I reflected on his words, because unlike most people in the class, I wasn't there to be part of a community team. I was the lone wolf. Fortunately, Mason had second thoughts. Actually, he added, perplexed, I guess the lamb gets picked off. I don't know what happens to the lone wolf. The next class, in which we role-played various disaster scenarios, was taught by a different fireman, Sergio Mayorga. Though he was less cynical than Mason, he was no less apocalyptic. Next week, after my terrorism lesson, he warned as class ended, you're not going to be able to sleep for 2 weeks. Lesson 34. Protecting yourself from snipers, dirty bombs, and salad bars. Why does terrorism exist? Sergio Mayorga asked. It was my final cert class. A box on the table behind him contained 40 much-coveted cert uniforms. At the end of the lesson, one of them would be mine. Envy? An older woman in front of me responded. Anger? An Asian businessman asked. It exists, Mayorga said, because it's faster than the political system. He paused to let the answer sink in. It's cheap, mobile, low-tech, and deniable. Most of all, it exists because it works. His argument made sense. Saying, please keep off my lawn, is a much less effective deterrent than, for example, aiming a shotgun at the trespasser and saying, get off my lawn or I'll blow your fucking brains out, and then doing it. No one will set a toe on your lawn again. Do you know what be nice means? He continued. You can use that acronym to remember the different types of terrorist threats. Biological, nuclear, incendiary, chemical, explosive. This decade, the James Bond supervillain, a non-national rogue with a heavily financed global conspiracy to destroy the world with no material benefit to himself, had actually stepped out of the realm of fantasy and into reality. As John Robb put it in his book, Brave New War, thanks to the leverage provided by technology, eventually, one man will be able to declare war on the world and win. Though fires are the cheapest and most common form of terrorism, Mayorga continued, the one with the highest risk factor is biological, because it will take a week or two before people start having symptoms and figure out what's going on. The water supply is one way for them to spread something. Another way is to use aerosol and spray the vegetable aisle in a grocery store or the salad bar at Soup Plantation. The room was silent as he spoke. Though wildfires and earthquakes were more likely, terrorism was more chilling. He said, in the event of a nuclear attack, we should hole up in either a basement or the third from the top floor of the highest building around, then cover all cracks and openings with plastic and duct tape. I opened my class binder and started taking notes. He said, a dirty bomb is more likely than a nuclear attack because it's easy to make. All someone has to do is build a pipe bomb, then fill it with radioactive material, which can be stolen from any doctor's office with an X-ray machine. I was writing as fast as I could. I recalled the instructions for making a rudimentary pipe bomb from one of Kurt Saxon's books. Just stick a plastic baggie in a pipe, fill it with safety match heads, add a piece of string as a fuse, and cap both ends. Even I could do that. He said, if you're in a shopping mall and someone sets off a dirty bomb, you have roughly 30 minutes to decontaminate. Why was I taking notes so furiously? He said, cover your nose and mouth immediately with anything that wasn't exposed. Was this ever really going to happen to me? He said, never use a cell phone or radio within a 1,000-foot radius of an explosion in case the frequency sets off a secondary device. How many dirty bombs had even been set off in American shopping malls? He said, if you rush toward the exits with everyone else, you risk not only being trampled, but also getting injured by a secondary device planted there. Instead, head to the bathroom, find the sprinkler, bust it open, and decontaminate yourself. And how often was I in a shopping mall? Almost never. He said, if you have to remove contaminated clothing, don't pull it over your head. Cut it off. Yet I continued scribbling away because I was haunted by the same demon everyone else in class was haunted by, just in case. I was reminded of a book I'd recently read on the Inquisition. For 500 years of Western history, the Catholic Church was much more extreme than today's Muslim fundamentalists. Its armies killed all the heretics they could get their hands on, wiping out entire religions by torturing, slaughtering, and burning alive nearly every devotee. Like the fatwas of hardline Muslims today, it even wrote edicts prescribing these genocidal terms. And because of these bloody measures, Christianity dominates the West today. In history, whether you look at the manifest destiny of America or the city-demolishing bombings that ended World War II, winning is killing. He said, if you're ever in a public area and someone starts spraying gunfire, get down on your stomach with your feet pointed toward the attacker, your face positioned away, and your hands covering your head. This way, it's less likely that the bullets will hit your vital organs. Scribble, scribble. Now this seemed more likely to happen. Slightly. He said, if you notice an absence of birds and mosquitoes, or you see people with drool, tears, and snot pouring out of their faces, not counting nurseries, it's more likely a chemical attack. Cover your nose and mouth, head upwind, and use the rule of thumb, which means getting far away enough from a chemical incident that when you stick your thumb out and squint at it, your digit covers the entire scene. Why hadn't anyone told me this before? I was glad I had to wait for my second passport. Otherwise, I might never have taken the time to learn about the dangers I was trying to protect myself from. He said, if chemicals from the attack get on your skin, rinse them off for 20 minutes with cool water while cleaning with soap and bleach. Don't use warm water, because it will open your pores. Fuck calculus, fuck trigonometry, fuck long division. This was cool knowledge, useful knowledge, life-saving knowledge. Even if my chances of using it were as likely as having to use the law of quadratic reciprocity in real life, at least it seemed practical. At least it slew one head of the many-headed demon, just in case. Afterward, with no test and little ceremony, we collected our uniforms and accreditations, including a certificate auspiciously signed by the mayor, stating that I was now qualified to serve the city in the event of a disaster. As a committed non-joiner of teams and committees, it wasn't the kind of honor I'd ever expected to receive. Lesson 35. How to make a man tell you anything. There's a program in the military that supposedly turns boys into men. It teaches downed Air Force pilots to survive behind enemy lines, and captured soldiers to resist interrogation. It's called SEER, and it stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. It's supposedly hardcore, and hardcore was what I needed if I wanted to learn to fend for myself in both America and St. Kitts. So I called Evan, the Green Beret I'd met at gunsight, and asked if they let civilians into SEER. SEER's gay, Evan replied instantly. They don't teach you how to survive. They teach you how to die slowly. What do you mean? They basically ask who wants to be an instructor, and whoever says yes gets to teach. You're better off reading a book. The only part that's kind of interesting is the interrogation. During his mock interrogation, Evan said he was imprisoned, tortured, and waterboarded. At night, his captors, fellow soldiers playing a role, blasted a Nazi SS march at deafening volume over and over until he was driven nearly mad with sleep deprivation. They got pretty sadistic, he continued, but people underestimate their ability to deal with pain. What got me wasn't the torture, but the psychological stuff. When they put my balls on a table and brought out a hammer, I just broke down. So maybe it's worth doing SEER just for the experience, I prodded. I mean, minus the balls thing. Nah, the rest is pretty lame. The guy you really want to go see is Tom Brown. Who's that? I'd never heard of him before. Tom Brown is the real deal. He teaches the guys who teach the Marines how to survive, if you know what I mean. All our snipers secretly go to that course. He's a civilian, but he's worked for OGA, other government agencies. If you want to learn how to live in the wilderness with nothing but the clothes on your back and a knife in your hands, go see Tom Brown. Fuck Sear. Those four words were among the best advice I'd gotten in my life. Go see Tom Brown. But there was a problem. Brown's tracker school was in a campground in the woods. And while camping may be a vacation to many people, it had always been like waterboarding to me. In Chicago, there wasn't much nature around the apartments where I grew up. In the desiccated grassy areas that the city called the parks, our main recreation as 12-year-olds wasn't camping or joining the Boy Scouts, but a game we called Jump the Bum. The object was to leap over sleeping and passed out homeless men in the park, either alone, in tandem, or in a choreographed mass, without waking them. We usually won. The only other nature experience I had was at overnight camp, but both times I went camping, it poured rain and the cheap tents leaked until we were wet, cold, and fed up. Maybe it was nature's revenge for our jump-the-bum games. After my camping washouts, I vowed never to set foot inside a tent again. After all, who needed tents when there were perfectly good hotel rooms nearby, with movies on demand and daily maid service? If I wanted to be a survivalist, however, I'd need to break that vow. To find appropriate gear, I called Justin Gunn, who, besides holding Dave Navarro's firearms for me, had been trying unsuccessfully to get me into one of his other hobbies, ultralight backpacking. The idea was to go hiking and camping with just a few pounds of equipment, most of it designed to weigh almost nothing and serve a variety of functions. Walking sticks doubled as tent poles, jackets converted into sleeping bags, backpack pads became sleeping mats. On Justin's advice, I bought a 1-pound waterproof, high thread count, spinnaker cloth tent, a 6.2-ounce nylon taffeta sleeping bag, a pair of lightweight SPF 40+ hiking pants with mesh-lined thigh vents and a reinforced seat, and a silicone-coated rip-stop nylon backpack. Since I'd last experienced it, camping, once a way to enjoy the outdoors and commune with nature, had turned into a market for advanced fabrics and technology, all designed to minimize any type of suffering created by interacting with the natural world. Unfortunately, I would suffer anyway. Lesson 36. Books That Kill. Even after I researched Tom Brown Jr. on the internet and discovered that nearly every person who ran a respected survival school had once been a student of his, even after I read his book The Tracker, in which he describes such boyhood adventures as walking miles in a snowstorm, wearing nothing but cut-off shorts, surviving weekends in the woods blindfolded, and perching two nights straight on a tree branch, avoiding wild dogs. Even after I learned he'd been shot 4 times while tracking criminals and found trails leading to some 160 dead bodies. Even after I watched the Tommy Lee Jones movie, The Hunted, in part based on Brown. Even as I flew to New Jersey to meet the man, I had no idea what a force of nature Tom Brown was. To this day, those two words alone continue to fill me with admiration and intimidation. After arriving at Brown's tracker school in the heart of the New Jersey Pine Barrens, the stomping grounds for most of his tales of nearly inhuman feats, I looked around the campground. Scattered throughout were various sweat lodges, wooden shelters, and a shower area consisting of several buckets and mirrors. The buckets were for hauling water from the creek nearby to wash with. The mirrors were for daily tick checks. The woods were crawling with infected deer ticks, which had a nasty habit of jumping onto passing humans, burying their heads in the flesh, gorging on blood, and if not stopped within 2 days, leaving a souvenir called Lyme disease. I found a clearing near an open-air lecture shelter and unpacked my 1-pound spinnaker cloth tent. It was the first tent I'd ever pitched by myself, and at the time, I thought I'd put it together correctly. By 8 p.m. that night, the temperature had dropped to 56 degrees. As we huddled on the benches of the lecture shelter, wrapped in sweatshirts and jackets, Brown stepped up to the podium. Seemingly impervious to the cold, he wore a faded gray tank top with wide cutouts on the sides that ran from his shoulders to his abdomen, exposing as much skin as it covered. Above him, a sign carved out of wood read, "No sniveling." "All right, holy shit," Brown bellowed, projecting deep into the woods. "Welcome to Tracker School. This is the center. This is where everything took place." He gestured grandly to the wilderness around him. "There's a vast difference between theory and experience," he continued. "If you don't believe me, watch TV. The survivor programs make me vomit. Snively assholes." His face reddened as he spoke. "Between Survivor, Man vs. Wild, and Survivor Man, I've got a nest of snivelers. Surviving in the woods for a year? That's not even getting your feet wet." In front of him, he had three Poland Spring water bottles lined up. He took a swig from one of them and crushed it dramatically in his hands. "You can walk into any store, and there are 5 survival manuals you can buy that will kill you. Same with those edible plant books. I recover the bodies in their pathetic shelters that don't work because they learned it badly." His unblinking eyes bulged furiously out of their sockets. He almost spit as he spoke his last words. "So forget you have a past." Unlike Kurt Saxon, Bruce Clayton, and the denizens of the survivalist boards, Brown wasn't of the Cold War school of survivalism. He didn't advocate stockpiling dozens of sacks of grain and hundreds of gallons of gasoline and thousands of rounds of ammunition. He advocated taking a stroll in the woods. "How many people can say that they're free?" he yelled at his students, a mix of Marines, hippies, businessmen, and a few psychiatric patients, hoping a week of primitive living would restore their balance. "How many people can take a walk for the rest of their lives and never need a damn thing from society?" Though Brown was 58, he looked anything but old. He had gray hair, parted on the right, and plastered by sweat, to a face chiseled like an aging superhero's. His flesh was an onion of tan, red, peeling skin in seemingly endless layers, testifying to countless exposures to the elements. His body was thick and powerful, and though it was beginning to atrophy, every slight sag seemed to tell a story few would ever know or experience. "Why would you want wilderness survival?" his voice raised to a shout. "Because of the what-if question. I'm going to hand you an insurance policy against the what-if question." Now he grew quiet. "By the time I'm done with you, you will be able to survive any place with nothing. I'll teach you to build shelters, make fire, forage for food, find water, even if you're in the Sahara." He was a fantastic performer. One minute he was a drill sergeant, then a preacher, then a crazy old coot. If he delivered even 1/10 of what he promised, attending tracker school would be the best decision I'd made since deciding to learn self-sufficiency. Equal parts fact, hyperbole, and self-mythologizing, the Tom Brown legend is on par with the stories of Paul Bunyan, Geronimo, and Mowgli from the Jungle Book. As he tells it, he had a childhood friend named Rick. And Rick had a grandfather who was a Lipan Apache scout and shaman known as Stalking Wolf, usually referred to as Grandfather, though not to be confused with Grandpa the PT. At age 7, Brown met Grandfather and spent the next 10 years learning about animals, the wilderness, and Native American life under the elder's almost frustrating figure-it-out-for-yourself tutelage, known as the coyote style of teaching. When he was 20, Brown stripped off his clothes, stepped into the woods, and lived by his wits for a year. When he returned, he started helping the police track missing children, hikers, and criminals in the forest. After Brown tracked a suspected robber and rapist who had eluded some 200 cops and firemen, the New York Times ran a front-page story on this amazing 27-year-old woodsman, though the suspect Brown discovered was reportedly acquitted of the crimes. A media frenzy ensued, and soon Brown was doing talk shows, signing a book deal, and opening his own school. Antisocial and somewhat misanthropic, Brown used to read his students excerpts from Touch the Earth, a collection of Native American wisdom. But when he noticed he wasn't connecting, he reinvented himself by studying televangelists and the title character from the campy action movie, Billy Jack. "Survival is an art, a philosophy, a doorway to the earth," Brown yelled at us. He pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and wiped the sweat up his forehead, along the top of his head, and around the back of his neck. "It's the fucking Garden of Eden. Anyone who says it's a struggle lacks knowledge and skills." By the time the lecture ended, it was 11 p.m., and the temperature had dropped several more degrees. I walked to my tent and zipped into my ultralight